Childhood companions and collector's items, educational tools and effigies. Dolls can be valued items for many, but what if they represent something more sinister? And could they have minds of their own?
You are listening to You Totally Made That Up, and we are a bi-weekly history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up. But they're all true, and we especially like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, woo-woo elements, so those parts may only be true to the people who live them. We don't go for the lore says or the legend goes, though. We want dates and names and all the facts we can find. And my name is Nash.
And my name is Tiff.
And we are your hosts. We're just going to jump right into it. Oh, but before we do, we always like to remind you guys, keep listening till after the stories are over because you're going to hear an outro. And that's going to tell you all the places you can find us social media wise. It'll tell you the blog and Instagram and Twitter and the email address, all that good stuff. So if you need to get in touch with us or want to get in touch with us, don't forget to keep listening and you'll hear how to do it. So today's topic is dolls. They're creepy dolls. And we thought we'd tell you guys a little bit about the history of just dolls in general before we go down the weird path. And mine actually gets kind of true crimey in a way. Did you have any like murdery mystery, anything with yours?
There's a little bit of mystery and mischief.
Mystery and mischief. Okay. So yeah, again, we're not overselling this. These are weird dolls, man, that we're talking about today. They're freaky. But let's talk about just dolls in general, and Tiff's going to take it away.
I certainly am. So jumping right off and quoting the Smithsonian about this, dolls have been a part of human play for thousands of years. In 2004, a 4,000-year-old stone doll was unearthed in an archaeological dig in the Mediterranean island of Pantelleria. The British Museum has several examples of ancient Egyptian rag dolls made of papyrus stuffed linen, and over millennia, toy dolls crossed continents and social strata. They were made from sticks and rags, porcelain and vinyl, and they've been found in the hands of children everywhere. And by virtue of the fact that dolls are people in miniature, unanimated by their own emotions, it's easy for a society to project whatever it wanted to on them. Just as much as they could be made out of anything, they could be made into anything. Which I think that's pretty succinct as far as the history of dolls. But if you want to dig a little further, from the website History of Dolls, which is very, very thorough and will, of course, be linked in our show notes, here's a little bit more. Archaeological evidence has shown that dolls may actually be the first toys created. They were initially made of materials that were most convenient, so mud, clay, bone. Stone, leather, wax, and wood. Wooden ones called paddle dolls are some of the oldest to have been found, and they were found in Egyptian tombs from around 2000 BC. There are Greek dolls from 200 BC that have articulating limbs, and in Roman graves where children were buried, there were some that contained dolls that were dressed in clothes representative of that day's fashion. African dolls are often used for education. Japanese dolls, dating back from 8,000 to 200 BC, were used as toys, but also in religious ceremonies. And then, as far as the topic of religion, related to that, dolls were used as effigies in magic rituals in various European, African, and Native American cultures. They were used as stand-ins for people on whom spells were cast, and that's probably taking you over to voodoo dolls, but that's going to be another episode. That'll be another time. So, bottom line. They were used as more than just toys in many respects. They mean a lot to people for various reasons. Like in my story, when, the meaningful doll became kind of an obsession. A very creepy, weird obsession. You ready for this, Nash?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? All right. Thomas Osgood Otto and Minnie Elizabeth Watkins Otto were affluent residents in Key West, Florida, already raising three children, when Robert Eugene Otto was born on October 25th, 1900. there's not a whole lot about his early life. You know, they were a wealthy family, lots of traveling, lots of nannies. In 1906, little Robert was gifted a doll, and it was not just any doll. It's a 40-inch doll, 40-inch tall.
That, wow.
Yeah, it's like one of those my size, you know, like one of those Barbie things that you find nowadays. But yeah, a 40-inch tall doll. And it was made, apparently, in his likeness, even using some of his hair.
Okay, now, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
This is like American Girl doll to on steroids. This is.
Yeah. Oh, dude. It's special. It's special. That's for sure. So where did the doll come from? According to a few sources, it was crudely handmade. And I need to jump in here because you know what? I don't like the way this doll looks, but to call it crude is a little bit over the top. Like,
I agree.
It's not realistic, but remember that this is like 100 years ago. They did what they could. So
I've seen pictures, and of course there's going to be pictures in the show notes. Dare I say, it's kind of cute.
Right. If it wasn't all messed up from age.
Yeah, it's just age. Like, put it this way, on the creepy doll scale, he's not even hitting a 4. I mean, it's not that creepy in and of itself. It really isn't. But anyway.
Yeah. So handmade by a Jamaican nurse who served the family. And it appears that she had put a hex on the doll because she was disgruntled by the treatment that she received from them. Details on that whole scenario are pretty sparse. But one source stated that she had bonded with the boy. And after some disagreement or another with the mother, Minnie, she was fired. But before leaving, she gave him the doll. Black magic, blah, blah, blah. Now, little Robert, the boy, he goes by Gene from his middle name, and he decided to name the doll after himself. So it's Robert the doll. And they were best friends, like right off the bat. So he dressed him in his old clothes. They played together. Pretty much wherever Gene went, Robert went. And it was super, super cute. Until it wasn't. Like when Gene would be overheard talking to Robert and Robert would respond in a totally different, deeper voice. Or when Gene would be fine one moment and then screaming the next and be found in his room with the furniture flipped over, items knocked off shelves, toys ripped apart. Or at times at night when he would wake up the entire house screaming and would be found curled up on his bed, crying and terrified, claiming that Robert was scaring him. In fact, it kind of became a thing that whenever something bad happened, things were broken, things got messed up, there was trouble around the house, Gene always said the same thing. Robert did it. And the doll was pretty unsettling to a lot of people within the home. The servants didn't like it. They claimed that they would often find the doll had been moved around and not by another person. Like, they would be in the same room, and the doll would be in one place, they turn around, and then the doll was in another. They would say that they would hear whispering or other talking or giggling whenever the doll was around or in a room that was unoccupied by anybody else. But Gene loved Robert, even though he messed with all of his shit, or maybe it was kind of like a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing with this doll. Whatever it was, that was his buddy. That was, you know, all the time, 24/7. Quoting from one of my sources, what people really remember is what they would probably term as an unhealthy relationship with the doll. He brought it everywhere. He talked about it in the first person as if it weren't a doll. It was Robert, as in a live entity. The doll was even given his own room, and Gene made sure that Robert had furniture, clothes, and even a bed. Stories of Robert the doll moving meant that he was quickly banished to the attic. Servants would arrive and then quit not too long afterwards because of different things that Robert had gotten up to and frightened them so much. There's also a claim that an aunt banished Robert to the attic and had actually died the same night that he was put up there. Now, despite being banished, the rest of the family said that they could hear Robert the doll moving around frequently in the upstairs portion of the house, that his footsteps would echo throughout different areas of the property that were completely empty. And then, of course, there was more giggling in the middle of the night, because what else would a creepy doll do? But nothing else direct or major seemed to happen at this point. It's just a lot of creepiness and mischief. And you think, Gene's eventually going to grow out of this. He did end up moving on. He attended the Academy of Fine Arts in Chicago, and he also attended the Art Students League in New York. And then he went to the Sorbonne in Paris, and that was where he met his wife, Annette Parker. She was a native of Boston who was studying music at the time. The two ended up getting married in Paris on May 3rd, 1930. After Anne had finished her studies in Paris, they moved to New York for several years, and Anne actually performed at the Rainbow Room at Rockefeller Center as an accomplished pianist. So I imagine with that kind of start to their relationship that she was like, man, we are going to have quite a life together. This is going to be sweet. But he and Anne ended up returning to Key West to his childhood home. He now called it Artist House because, I don't know, when you're wealthy and eccentric, you name your estate. Or I don't know what the parameters are for getting to name your estate, naming your house. But it's now called Artist House. Not the Artist House or an Artist's House. Artist House. It really bothers me.
I couldn't tell at all.
So now he's in his 30s. He's living in his childhood home with his wife. He's making art. She now gets to be a housewife. And he's hanging out with his doll. And Robert is back on all of his mischief. And he's again heard making noises and giggling, making faces at people. Yes, now people are claiming that he makes angry faces at them or gives them like a little cocky smirk or gives them evil eyebrows. Children in the neighborhood would avoid the house because they said that they would see Robert looking out the window and he would change position often, or he would even turn to follow them as they walked. People didn't like Robert, except for Jean. And Jean's wife, Anne, God bless her, she put up with some shit being married to this guy. And she didn't like Robert. I imagine for many reasons, probably the main one being that your adult husband is fixated on an ugly doll that's like 40 years old. But also, she was creeped out by it because of all these weird noises and things that have been happening. So she tells Jean, put that thing up in the attic. Which I'm sure she actually said, put that thing in the garbage. But Jean heard attic. And he did listen to her. But after a short while, Jean comes back down to Anne and he says, Robert doesn't like the attic. In fact, Robert the doll demands specifically to be placed in the turret room because it has a view of the street and Robert wants to be able to look outside.
Okay, I'd have dipped at this point. I'd be like, nah, you know what? I'll do you one better. He can have whatever room he wants. He can have the other side of the bed because I'm not going to be in it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But she stuck around. And Jean, he did move Robert to the turret room. And then he ended up pretty much staying in the turret room. That's where he would create, like, his art. And he could be found talking to Robert as an adult with a wife. It boggles my mind that this was just allowed to happen. And it went on for years until he died in 1974. And she didn't deal with Robert after that. So all of this stuff had continued to happen. There were even some stories, and I couldn't really find a whole lot that backed it up, that Anne was driven nuts, like actually insane by all of this, but I imagine it did not go well. So it's 1974, Jean dies, the house is sold to a woman named Myrtle Reuters. Myrtle moves into the home, she's checking things out, she comes across this funky, old-as-fuck doll that was left behind by the previous owner, and she decides to keep it. What? I don't like decisions that people make. Like, I don't know, blame it on different times. It's the 70s. Maybe just hung on to stuff that people left. But I don't know.
LSD? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that was it. So she hangs on to Robert the doll. And as one source puts it, became his new caretaker. Yeah.
Oh, no.
She has people that come and stay at the house, and the tenants start noticing weird things. Again, with the footsteps in the attic where Robert's kept. A journalist came to visit the home because they wanted to talk about Jean, and he saw the doll, and he said that it looks like a little boy being punished based on the look on its face. And then they started kind of talking about the history of Robert the doll, and they said that the face that was on the doll changed as they talked about it. And when some things were said about Jean that weren't so friendly, apparently the face became angry. She claimed things similar to what Jean claimed, that Robert would create nonsense all around the home. Footsteps in rooms that should be empty, there's giggling. He terrified a plumber that came to work at the home by moving across the room, again like what had happened with the servants, and throwing items that would randomly appear in his lap. There was lots of showing up in places that were different than where he had been left before. Sometime in the 80s, Myrtle ended up moving from Artist House, and as she packed up her shit, she also packed up Robert and took him along. Again, I need to know why. I need to know why people are so attached to this freaking doll. But whatever. The relationship didn't last forever. Finally, in 1994, she donates the doll to the Fort East Martello Museum. But don't worry, you guys. She made sure to tell them that he was haunted. So she didn't just dump him there and be like, your problem, bye. She was like, it's haunted. You guys need to be nice to Robert the doll here. And that's where the doll is today. He gets his own display. He's like chilling in a chair. He's wearing Jean's old sailor outfit, which there's actually a picture of Jean as a child wearing the same outfit. So it's definitely his. And Robert the doll is even holding his own little stuffed animal. Some people say that it's a lion, but other people say it's a little stuffed dog. People still say that his expression changes. And if you talk shit about Jean Otto, he gets mad and will even kind of get the angry lips. I don't know. I don't really know how this doll's face gets angry, but apparently it does. He also gets mad if you take a picture of him without asking for permission first. And if you do so, you're going to suffer bad luck. So many people have apparently done this that they write letters to Robert asking for forgiveness.
But how do you know if you've gotten permission?
You just ask. I think the whole point is just asking first and not just being like, what's up, Robert? Click. I think you have to be like, Robert, can I take your picture? And then you can click it.
I mean, like, does it give like a little, you know, chin tilt? Like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Quick little.
Yeah, raise of the eyebrow. You know,
I don't know.
It's a cute doll. I'm in the camp that it's cute. I think it's cute, but you know, I don't see anything sinister about it, but okay.
Yeah. And so people have claimed various things as far as the bad luck. That they immediately after leaving the museum fell and like broke an arm, that they started suffering different malfunctions like on their camera or on their phone, that the bad luck followed them when they got home, car accidents, different things like that. So, like I said, they write letters to Robert asking for forgiveness, and his museum caretaker actually reads them to him and posts them near the display so that Robert knows what's going on. So don't worry, guys. You're not being ignored by Robert the doll.
This is dumb. This is actually dumb.
So yeah. So, you know, usually I'm the one I try really hard to like let the mystery hang and be like, ooh, that's creepy. Who knows what's out there? But not today. Not today. This is too stupid to let linger. And I am not sorry at all. So let's go back to the beginning and set a few things straight. Robert the doll is not a cursed gift from a Jamaican nurse. The doll's origins can be traced to the Stafe Company out of Germany. And as it turns out, his grandfather gave it to him after returning from a trip. And if you don't mind, I'm going to go on a slight tangent here because I feel like we need a little bit of like happy story before we finish out this weird one. So here's a little bit of bonus history for you. Marguerite Stafe was born in 1847. When she was 18 months old, a fever led to paralysis in her legs and chronic pain in her right arm. But she was determined, and I kind of love her. So she went to school with the help of her siblings and neighbors who would like take her in a hay cart and help her and carry her up the stairs to the classrooms. When she's 17, she attended sewing school, which, you know, if you've got chronic pain and it's hard to use your right arm, that's not going to be easy. But she went through it and she ended up becoming a seamstress. She worked for her sisters and then took over the business years later. And I love that her family assisted her and helped her to achieve independence. Like, they were so awesome for her. So they even adapted her sewing machine for her and encouraged her to start her own clothing company. And so she did. She made clothes from felt, and it got so successful that she was actually able to hire her own employees. One day, she comes across a pattern for a little stuffed elephant to use as a pincushion. And she whips that bad boy up, and it's quickly discovered that little kids love this little elephant to play with. So she starts making those, and her brother sells them at the market. And within like 6 years, they sell 5,000 of them. and she starts branching out to other little animal designs too. In 1892, there was a catalog that was actually produced by them and shows all of the different animal toys that they were making. There were elephants, monkeys, donkeys, horses, camels, pigs, mice, dogs, cats, rabbits, and giraffes. Now in 1897, Richard Stafe, Marguerite's nephew, and he was really, really creative. He attended an art school. They were using his sketches for the basis of lots of the animal's creations. So he designs this stuffed bear with movable arms and legs and decides that they should cover it with mohair plush. And then an American trader discovers the bears, orders 3,000 of them, and then they become a huge success in the U.S. starting in 1906 when they became called the teddy bear because of Theodore Roosevelt. Okay, so there's the teddy bear story.
And Teddy Roosevelt is my favorite president.
He was a wild man. Oh my gosh.
I actually had a dream the other night. I think just politics is on my mind. And just with, look, regardless of where you fall politically, I think you have to admit things are in a bit of disarray in the U.S. right now. And I had a dream. I'm not kidding, because I almost want to talk about him one day, so I don't want to go down this road. He actually got shot and the bullet lodged in his chest, but it didn't, you know, like puncture a lung or anything like that. But even through that massive amount of pain, the man still went on to give like an hour and 20 minute speech or something. It was something insane, like an 80 minute speech. It was something nuts. If you look up badass in the dictionary, he's the definition of it. But I had a dream that Teddy Roosevelt rode in on a horse and just like started whooping ass at the White House. That he had literally, like, my dream was that, like, in a news report style, and like that Twitter, Teddy Roosevelt started trending. These were all blips in my weird ass dream. And then I turned on the TV and people were like, Teddy Roosevelt is apparently back from the dead and we don't have to worry anymore. Because apparently he's just going to ride. He's going to ride through the country kicking ass and taking names, and he's all out of bubblegum. And that's a reference that, I don't know, maybe our audience will get that reference. I'm not going to explain it. I digress. So teddy bears. Yay.
Teddy bears. Oh my God. All right. So what does the teddy bear story have to do with Robert the Doll? Because I didn't mention them making dolls. That's because they didn't really manufacture dolls for sale. The Stafe Company made them for window displays for storefronts. So Robert the Doll wasn't meant to be a child's toy at all. He was meant to be posed with other toys to kind of show what a kid would look like surrounded by all of these other little trucks and wagons, whatever the hell it would have been at that time. But Grandpa Otto probably got him on a deal when they were changing things out or just paid enough and managed to get it. And when it was originally painted, because the face was painted on the fabric at the time, it was made to look like a jester or a clown, which adds to why the doll is now known for the creepy features, because he has no expression because all the paint has worn off. All you see right now are the beady black eyes that were sewn in and the sewn spots around the lips and the nose. And Stafe still doesn't make many dolls. So if you go on the website and you just search for dolls, they still have a pretty similar design as far as how Robert the Doll was made and the new ones. And then the other thing that I need to make sure that I mention, Chucky. You know, the Child's Play movies, Chucky the Doll. When you do a quick Google search and you're looking up anything about Robert the Doll, all the results say that Robert was the inspiration for Chucky. But no, that is not the case. There are some similarities, and the writer-creator, Don Mancini, has stated that all of that's just coincidence, and he actually created Chucky because of the Cabbage Patch dolls and the My Buddy doll craze of the early to mid-80s. And of course, in show notes, there's going to be a commercial clip for the My Buddy. And do I actually need to remind anyone of what Cabbage Patch dolls were like? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think they're still around. And I had a kid sister doll. That was the counterpart to My Buddy. Yeah, I had kid sister.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at the My Buddy and you look at the Chucky doll, how they managed to get around that as far as not getting sued.
Right.
Is pretty, pretty amazing. So. But what about all of the weirdness? You know, because there were a lot of people throughout the history of this doll to have said that they heard these footsteps, that they heard these giggles, that Robert was talking in voices, and Well, it was also said in some of the sources, you know, that Gene had developed this odd relationship to the doll, but also made sure to point out that his family was wealthy and they were well-traveled, probably too well-traveled to actually spend time with the children. So we've got wealthy, secluded, artsy little Gene that's left unsupervised and in need of attention. So what is a boy to do? So yeah, I kind of think that it, you know, Gene just really went out there to get attention. I don't think that he was able to separate himself from Robert, even though Robert was his name. Maybe that was part of why. Anyways, and Myrtle, the lady that bought the house afterwards and became his caretaker, I think that she just bought into the urban legend. But I want to know if any of our listeners have actually gone to visit Robert at the little museum down in Key West, or if I know that he has traveled to a couple of other things. I want to know if anyone has visited Robert, or if you've bought, because if you go to the website, you can actually buy a little replica that even comes with his own little stuffed animal. And he's also very active on social media. His Facebook page is updated very regularly, and they respond to a lot of people. Or if anyone else has had to apologize for farting in his presence, like Ozzy Osbourne. I came across a clip from some show that Ozzy Osbourne did. And Jack was berating him for having farted in his presence, and he had to apologize. So I hope that that hasn't caused any problems for Ozzy. But I don't know. That's Robert the Doll, you guys. He was a mischievous little shit. But I personally think that it was just the actual Robert who didn't know how to differentiate his personality from a doll. What do you think, Nash?
I think his wife is the one that I don't know why she stayed. I have no idea why she stayed. I mean, he clearly thought he was being funny, but it's not funny.
No. I don't know if he thought he was being funny. I think that he just, it was like an inside joke that literally only he got, I suppose. I don't know. I don't like him. I don't like Gene. I don't like Robert the Doll. I am sad for Anne that she was an accomplished pianist in New York, and then she ended up being tormented by this man and his doll. I don't like it.
I don't either.
Okay. I'm glad we're in agreement. Anne should have stayed in New York playing her piano at the Rainbow Room. Gene, he could go back to the artist house. I'm okay with him going back there because he was a weirdo. So he can go live out his days alone without tormenting perfectly fine woman with a doll. And I should stop now because I'm just going to keep ranting about this. I have feelings about Robert the Doll and how stupid that whole thing is. And you know what? Fine. Robert, whatever. I'm talking shit about you. I'm talking shit about Gene. I don't care. You're not going to do anything. You're a doll.
Because you're a doll.
Fight me. All right. That's it. That's Robert the Doll. Tell me something else, Nash.
Well, I've got mischievous boys. I've got some true crime. Listen, we're about to go on a journey, kids. Buckle up. I take you to Edinburgh, Scotland, and I looked that up. And various places on the internet told me that I'm saying it correctly, I swear. I actually said it that way in the last episode. Nobody wrote to correct me, so I'm going to run with it. Anyway, enough about me. We're in Edinburgh, and it's late June of 1836. And specifically, we're in an area called Holyrood Park that is described in one of my sources as 650 acres of semi-wilderness. And even more specifically, we're in a mountainy place known as Arthur's Seat. A group of five boys were out rabbit hunting, and they made an interesting find. Over a dozen coffins. They weren't buried, though. What had gotten the kids' attention was that a small cave they passed by had its entrance blocked with about three slate slabs that were noted as being crudely cut, so clearly a person had done it, not a natural occurrence. And they're curious, so they pull the stones away. Now, per the Edinburgh Daily News, it was more like a niche than a cave, roughly a foot in height and 18 inches across. What the hell, you think? How are a bunch of coffins in there? Maybe shoeboxes? But Nash, have you lost your mind? Possibly, but not over this. Here's the scoop. Quote, the boys found 17 coffins, each about 3.7 inches long, arranged in three tiers, two rows of eight, and a solitary coffin at the start of a third row. Inside each was a small wooden doll, its face carved with wide open eyes, dressed in plain cotton clothes that covered the thin body from bare head to flat feet. So dolls, y'all, not people. For now, subtle hint there.
Okay.
Because you know, ma'am, I'm subtle. Regarding what the coffins and dolls looked like, from the Scotsman newspaper, quote, miniature figures of the human form cut out in wood, the faces in particular being pretty well executed. Decently laid out with a mimic representation of all the funeral trappings, which usually form the last clothing of the dead. The coffins are regularly shaped and cut out from a single piece of wood, with the exception of the lids, which are nailed down with wire sprigs or common brass pins. The lid and sides of each are profusely studded with ornaments, formed with small pieces of tin and inserted in the wood with great care and regularity. So, pictures for you in show notes, of course. Charles Hoyfort, an American writer and researcher who is described as specializing in anomalous phenomena, and actually we've got him bookmarked for another episode, so I'm not going to get into him just now, but he described the circumstances of the coffin's placement in the London Times, July 20th, 1836 edition, saying, quote, the coffins had been deposited singly in the little cave and at intervals of many years. In the first tier, the coffins were quite decayed, and the wrappings had moldered away. In the second tier, the effects of age had not advanced so far, and the top coffin was quite recent looking. In other words, somebody had come back multiple times to hide the dolls over some period of time. But on the other hand, according to the Smithsonian, quote, whether the decay was the product of time or simply weathering is now not possible to say. It may be that the decayed coffins were simply those that occupied the lower tier in the burial nook and so were the most exposed to water damage. If that's the case, there is no need to assume that the burials stretched over many years. But again, regardless, these were carefully crafted and purposefully tucked away. And who was behind the making and the hiding of the dolls remains a mystery to this day. But of course, theories abound, and we're going to get to those in a second. So what happens next? In the first known published account of the dolls in the Scotsman, quote, a number were destroyed by the boys, pelting them at each other as unmeaning and contemptible trifles. Kids, man. But apparently, they spilled the beans to their schoolmaster, a Mr. Ferguson, and he happened to be a member of a local archaeological group, and he hightails it up there, and he finds that while the kids had dicked around with them, they didn't open them. And a reporter called Robert Chapman wrote, Mr. Ferguson took them home in a bag, and that evening he settled down in his kitchen and began to pry the lids up with a knife. Mr. Ferguson took them to the next meeting of his society, and his colleagues were equally amazed. And yeah, because as said, these were not hastily crafted. There's tons of detail. Lots of care was put into these little suckers, which the boys didn't care about. In any event, eight of the coffins survived these turd muffins chucking them at each other. And after their teacher had them, they end up in the possession of a collector called Robert Fraser, who puts them on display. After he retires in 1845, they were auctioned off and were, quote, described in the sale catalog as the celebrated Lilliputian coffins found on Arthur's Seat. Lilliputian. I love it. They sold. Then they float. Hey, I love how all our episodes are starting to kind of weave together, you know?
Yeah.
Listen to the astrology episode and you'll get that reference. Okay. So they sold, then they floated around who knows where until 1901 when they were donated to the National Museum of Scotland, where they remain to this day. So, okay, great. But who was behind this? Are there any clues that may tell us? There are. Like I say, they were found in 1836, and researchers Alan Simpson and Simon Menifee believe, based on the aging, that yes, they were made in the 1790s to 1800s ballpark and were likely hidden within about 5 years of their discovery. Two of the coffins were originally painted pink or red, and I didn't see why that was mentioned as being significant unless it has to do with what was available at the time. But they do mention how the lining of one is with rag cloth that was dated to a period post-1780. Regarding the construction, they've determined the wood is Scots pine and appears to have been carved with a hook knife, but that, quote, the user has apparently not been a woodworker by trade because he has not had access to an edged tool such as a chisel to cut out the base of the recess and has had difficulty in controlling the depth of the cuts. Regarding the tin decorations, quote, analysis of this metal suggests that it is very similar to the sort of tin used in contemporary shoe buckles, and this in turn opens the possibility that the coffins were the work of shoemakers or leather workers who would have had the manual skills to make the coffins, but would have lacked the specialist carpentry tools needed to make a neater job of it. As for the dolls themselves, while the coffins are nearly identical in size, the dolls aren't. Matter of fact, some of them have had their arms removed in order to fit into the coffins, so Simpson and Menifee speculate that they were something else, like toy soldiers, and were repurposed for whatever the person or people who made the coffins wanted for question mark reason. There's more detail in the Smithsonian article that I'll have linked for you in show notes as to why they thank toy soldiers specifically, but I won't go down that road here for time's sake. So they disagree with the whole these represent dead people thing that the Scotsman article suggested for two reasons. One, the open eyes of the dolls. If they were supposed to be dead, that'd be an easy thing to nick or sand off, you know, the pupils, the eyelashes that you'll see in the pictures to make them look like their eyes were closed. And secondly, the clothing, because, quote, the style of dress does not relate to period grave clothes. And if it is intended to be representational at all, then it is more in keeping with everyday wear. And as far as the fabric goes, it's described as cheap, plain woven cotton, four of which had patterns to them that were, as they put it, commercially inked. So not like sewn in designs or embroidery or whatever. But the material used makes dating the time frame easier. And experts on historical textiles say the mixture of the 1, 2, and 3-ply thread used to sew the clothes pretty definitively puts them in the 1830s range, because specifically that 3-ply thread was not made until after 1812. But the 3-ply wasn't used on all of the dolls, so again, maybe this was a situation where the dolls were being placed in their hidey hole bit by bit over the years, using what materials were more readily available at each time. Still, if so, they think it wasn't over 20 years or something, that it was more like a handful of years, because the ones that were moldy and whatnot weren't just horribly damaged as compared to the rest. So that's your basic overview. Like I say, tons more detail across the sources that'll be in show notes, but you get the idea. They're really neat and also kind of creepy. Mostly neat, though, in my opinion. Still, little dolls and coffins, so yikes.
Hey, Karina, do you want to hear an interesting new fact about sloths?
Impossible, Cassie. I know all there is to know about sloths. They spend their whole lives eating and sleeping, and that's living the dream in my book.
I bet you don't know this fact.
Fine, surprise me.
Sloths are surprisingly fast and skilled swimmers. They can move 3 times faster in water than they ever can on land.
Suddenly, I love them even more. Where can I possibly learn more exciting and interesting facts about sloths?
Well, we did do an entire episode on sloths for Crittercast.
Right! Crittercast, our comedic animal-themed podcast. It's the show where we talk about all kinds of animals and why we love them.
We upload new episodes twice a month on every 2nd and 4th Sunday.
Just in time for your Monday morning commute. You can find Crittercast on iTunes, Spotify, and many other podcast streaming apps.
Plus, check out our website,
CritterCastPodcast.com,
for links to all of our social media and for more fun facts and adorable photos of critters big and small.
CritterCast Podcast.
But okay, so we've got the time frame, yet here we are again, who done it and why. So let's go over the theories, and there's one in particular I think will be of most interest to y'all, so I'm not going to get into tons of particulars on each of these. I just want to give you the general idea of what people were and are thinking. Some had to do with loved ones who died while they were away from home, either overseas or actually on the sea, as in sailors. The Edinburgh Evening Post suggested that the coffins were rooted in, quote, an ancient custom which prevailed in Saxony of burying in effigy departed friends who had died on a distant land. And the Caledonian Mercury reported about, quote, a superstition which exists amongst some sailors in this country that they ask their wives on parting to give them a Christian burial in effigy if they were lost at sea. Having said that, George Dalgliesh, who is with the National Museum, said in 2015 that there isn't any evidence of such ceremonial burial practices in Scotland. Okay, so nothing really solid there. But there was a group in Scotland in this area around this time who possessed proficiency in both carving and weaving, who could have feasibly made the dolls. And the writer and researcher Jeff Nisbet calls them the Scottish Gypsies. Now, I normally would default to saying Romani, as my understanding is that or travelers is the preferred terminology, but I'm uncertain as to what is most accurate for this particular area. And the article that discusses this is from 2017, and he's actually capitalizing it. So, you know, feel free to write in and educate me. I certainly don't mean to offend here. This may be a regional thing. I'm not sure. So he talks about how the curved knife, those other historians mentioned, was a favorite tool in this group for their carving, and that they would sell, amongst other things, little peg dolls, which are fashioned from old-timey wooden clothespins. And I'll stick a picture in show notes for you. And they'd be dressed in clothes too. And the coffin dolls are also really similar to a certain type of Egyptian doll, also frequently in coffins, called ushtabi or shtabi. And they were, quote, funerary figures in ancient Egypt who accompanied the deceased to the afterlife. So again, effigies, basically. what does this have to do with these Scottish gypsies? Well, Nisbet says, quote, one of the names given to gypsies in early Scottish records is Egyptians, perhaps due to the belief that Egypt was the group's country of origin, a belief that they are known to have encouraged. While recent genetic studies have shown that the gypsy blood group left India some 1,500 years ago, there is the distinct possibility that some of the nomadic group made their way to the UK through Egypt. Okay, then, basically that this was something passed down through the generations, something cultural that was picked up via migration. Nisbet also goes into a theory that is all his own. Basically, he posits that these dolls were some sort of memorial to do with an event called the Radical War of 1820, which is when, quote, weavers and other workers across the Central Belt were moved to acts of civil disobedience because of worsening economic conditions and launched protests and strikes calling for better conditions and rights. Nisbet talks about how the unemployed weavers were, quote, put to work building a path around Arthur's Seat, known to this day as Radical Road, and that the coffins were a coded memento left by those who wanted to see the movement rise again. By the time the coffins were discovered, the rebellion had been largely forgotten, save, perhaps, by those whose loved ones had been lost to the hangman's noose.
That's a pretty, like, particular, very specific theory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And historians, from what I've read, other historians have been very kind and said, this is really fascinating. You know, we don't buy it, but it's really fascinating. Like, that's... It's cool. And it's cool that he's bringing attention to something that's, like he said, kind of fallen away to history. Mm-hmm. But they don't agree. Okay.
Yeah.
But let's get more into the out there stuff, shall we? They were touted as fairy coffins by some.
Of course. Of course.
Of course. And that could have been facetious because they were so tiny. I don't know. But I do know I don't have the strength to talk about fairies. That one episode that we did last year, it wiped me out. And of course, there were some people who thought that this had to do with witchcraft.
Okay.
Quoting here, "Satanic spell manufactory," wrote the Scotsman, speculating there may still be some of the weird sisters hovering about who retain their ancient power to work the spells of death by entombing the likenesses of those they wish to destroy.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yep. Copy that. Now, there are tales of witch goings-on in and around Arthur's Seat, and it is documented that it was in Edinburgh that most witch burnings took place, more than anywhere else in Scotland, back in the 16th century. But that historian I mentioned earlier, Dalgliesh, says that if they were associated with witchcraft, it's likely they wouldn't have been in, you know, cute little clothes and meticulous coffins and tucked away in a hidey hole. They'd have been looking mutilated and partially destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So to sum up, maybe they were something to do with woo-woo. Maybe they were representative of loved ones lost at sea. Maybe they were related to political strife. Maybe they were culturally associated. But maybe, just maybe, they were symbols of something sinister.
Yes.
We remain in Scotland, but I now take you back in time to when doctors, specifically anatomists, were in a pickle. These years, starting in the late 1600s and going through the 1800s, were known as the resurrectionist times when, quote, the demand for cadavers among Scotland's budding anatomists outpaced the legal supply of unclaimed foundlings, orphans, paupers, executed criminals, suicides, and victims of violent death. By the 1710s, doctors' assistants were regularly unearthing bodies from Scottish cemeteries during the night, protected from discovery by the fact that no one except the most hardy would in that age venture near a churchyard after the gloaming. I love that, ooh, the gloaming. To break that down, like it said, it was legal for cadaver dissection to be done on unclaimed bodies and suicides and murders and executed criminals, but otherwise, nope. And I talked about this actually at the end of the episode called Ghosted Part 2, about the hanged criminals end of it. So these resurrectionists, as they were called, would go and dig up bodies as quickly as they could after burial so they'd be, you know, fresh.
Fresh, yeah.
Yeah. The ideal bodies were the ones that had no damage to them. So the folks that died of natural causes, because this wasn't about like forensic science to try to work your way backwards to solve a murder or something. At this point, it was about, hey, maybe they're old and their organs are old, but otherwise everything's intact. And lots of times, like that quote said, physicians' assistants were the ones who were doing the digging up, but the anatomists would also pay randoms for the bodies. Kind of a no questions asked type of thing.
Yeah, that's good policy. There we go.
Here's a couple examples of when just that I have to share with you of when things went sideways, according to the 1884 book, The History of Burke and Hare and of the Resurrectionist Times. Keep those names in mind. We're going to come back to them. On one occasion, two rando dudes dig up a man, last name of Henderson, stuff him into a sack. It must have been a huge sack. I mean, my stars. And they decide they want to stop off for a drink. So into a pub slash inn they go, dragging said giant sack with them. When the cops stop by to ask the owners if some grave robbers they were looking for had maybe come by, these dudes panic and they knew they had to stash the body. So they sneak into a room, get the body out of the sack, and they lay it out in a bed so it looks less like, well, a corpse in a sack and more like somebody who's just sleeping. They take off. They're never caught. Here's what they didn't know. It just so happened that the family who owned the pub and inn were, you guessed it, the Hendersons. And so later on that night, Mrs. Henderson walks into her bedroom and quote,
oh,
yeah. 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 I mean, this right here is in the fuck uppery hall of fame. Later that night, Mrs. Henderson walks into her bedroom and quote, discovered her husband lying there clad in the grave clothes she had made with her own hands.
Oh, God. Whew. Okay.
And more disturbing is when you get into examples of people who, I suppose, desperate for money, would murder in order to sell a body to the doctors. One case of note is from 1752, where two nurses named Helen Torrance and Jean Waldy met a woman and her son, who is about 8 years old, on the street. They get to chatting with the woman, and they invite her over for a drink. And while one of them was distracting the mom, the other goes and finds the boy who's in another room looking out a window. She suffocates him, hides the body at her house, which is nearby, and goes back and is all, I have looked and looked, and your kid just must have run off. End quote. Torrance and Waldy took the corpse to the surgeon's rooms where they were offered 2 shillings for it, the one who had carried it receiving 6 pence additional. And y'all know I damn well converted that. So here we go. 2 shillings and 6 pence in 1752 is equal to $21.90 American. So they killed a kid for $20.
What? Oh my God. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Like today's money. I mean, I don't mean that like that was the equivalence back then. I mean, today's money, yeah. You know, so back then, yeah. Uh-huh.
Gross.
All right. So this grave robbing stuff got to the point that people were taking turns guarding their deceased family members' graves or would hire somebody to do it, basically until such a time as the body would be good and rotted and useless to the anatomist. Sometimes they'd even have iron gates with stone coverings called mort safes installed over the graves. And I'm not going to get into that because I've got weird coffin and grave and body stuff tucked away for another episode for y'all. Anyway, beyond that, in terms of people's reactions to all this, there was an incident of a riot that ended up with an Edinburgh Anatomy Theater being destroyed. Another time there was a riot and destruction at Glasgow's medical school. I mean, people were pissed. So this goes on. And then in 1832, the Anatomy Act was passed. And amongst other things, it was saying to physicians, look, we get it. And you can still have executed prisoners and unclaimed bodies, but this purchasing corpses thing has got to stop. First off, if you want to do dissections, you got to have a license from the Home Secretary. There's going to be inspectors who pop in occasionally to make sure you're practicing on the up and up. And we're also going to allow people to basically put in their wills if they're cool with their body being donated to science. If family members object, even though the person said it was fine, then you don't get the body. But otherwise, have at it. And conversely, even if a person hadn't specifically said it was their wishes, if the family chose to donate the body, that's fine too. And this helped. It really did. Even though some folks still thought the practice of dissection was just horrible and shouldn't be done and fuck science and knowledge, full stop. Don't get me started. But there had been something of a tipping point that caused this legislation to get drawn up and passed, which was a series of murders that happened between 1827 and 1828. Why are we talking about this, Nash? What about the dolls? And I'm getting there.
I trust you. Take me on this journey.
Y'all have to trust me. If y'all don't trust me by now, this is episode damn, what, 26?
Something.
Y'all got to trust me. We've been on a journey together. It's been almost a year. All right. I need to tell you about two men, both named William. And so we're going by their last names, which are Burke and Hare. Both are from Ireland. Burke was born in 1792 and Hare was born between then and 1804, but they didn't know each other at this point. Now, Burke had a decent upbringing. His family was middle class and he served in the military and he got married, but then he ditched his wife in 1818 and moved to Scotland to work on the Union Canal and settled in Falkirk with his new gal, a woman named Helen MacDougall. They eventually moved to Edinburgh, where he became a pretty successful cobbler. Quote, "He became known locally as an industrious and good-humored man who often entertained his clients by singing and dancing to them on their doorsteps while plying his trade." I mean, all right, chipper fellow.
Sure. Just, you know, do your thing, man. All right.
I don't know that I particularly trust your cobbling skills more if you're doing a jig on my porch, but okay. Less is known about Hare. Not certain where in Ireland he was from, but he is thought to have been a farm laborer. And after leaving Ireland for Scotland, he also happened to work on the Union Canal for a time before he ended up in Edinburgh too, working as an assistant to a coal distributor. He lived at a place called Tanner's Close, which was a boarding house owned by a Logue and Margaret Laird. And when Logue dies in 1826, Hare and Margaret hook up. And what was he like? Well, quote, "illiterate and uncouth, a lean, quarrelsome, violent, and amoral character with the scars from old wounds about his head and brow." And while we're here, Margaret was described as, quote, "a hard-featured and debauched virago," which I don't know about y'all.
What a pair. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I don't know about y'all. I had to refresh my memory on virago, and that means a woman given to undue belligerence or ill manner at the slightest provocation, a shrew, scolding, domineering, or highly opinionated, rough, loud, and aggressive. So these two are just peaches.
Yeah.
And the two couples crossed paths in 1827 when they both went to Midlothian to pick up work at harvest time. They get along great. And Burke and Helen end up moving into Hare and Margaret's boarding house where, quote, "the two couples soon acquired a reputation for hard drinking and boisterous behavior." Nice. So in late 1827, there's a man nicknamed Old Donald who's staying at the boarding house and who is, you know, old. And he dies of natural causes. My assumption being they just find him dead in his room one day. But he still owed rent when he died. Hare knows that he can get cash for corpse, so he asks Burke to help him out with getting Old Donald to a doctor, specifically Professor Robert Knox, who is a well-known anatomy lecturer. Burke and Hare stuff the coffin with tanning bark, which I looked up and is basically just piles of leather, doing it to make the coffin seem heavy, and I guess nobody looked inside before they buried it. It sounds like Old Donald had no family because one source noted that he was an army pensioner and that the local parish was paying for the coffin and the burial. Whatever. Point is, they get away with it. They get the body to Dr. Knox's place and are paid a total of about £8, which they split. And then as they're leaving, quote, "one of Knox's assistants told them that the anatomist would be glad to see them again when they had another corpse to dispose of." If you're thinking that these two saw this as a business opportunity, you're correct. Now, the order of what happens next is a little up in the air because it's based on different recollections. But here's the ballpark sequence of events. Touching on just a handful of their victims, because, spoiler, they end up killing way more than a handful. We're now in 1828, and there's another boarder who looks like a good mark. His name is Joseph, and he's sick with something or other. One place said his fever is so high that he's borderline delirious. And since Margaret and Hare were worried that having him around would be bad for business, they go to Burke, and it's all, hey, let's get rid of him and make some scratch. So they get him liquored up on whiskey, and Hare puts a pillow over his face while Burke lays across his chest, and they suffocate him. Because again, the ideal bodies for the anatomists are the ones that don't have any big trauma going on. But this also leaves no marks in terms of it looking like a person was murdered, like if there was evidence of strangulation around his neck or something like that. Matter of fact, historian Lisa Rosner writes regarding this technique and associating it with murder that it would have been, quote, "practically undetectable until the era of modern forensics."
Oh.
Yeah, so they have unwittingly kind of stumbled upon what's going to become their chosen technique. So Burke and Hare take him to Dr. Knox. Nobody questions anything. And smothering this way did become their chosen shtick. And later it was actually called Burking. Okay. So then came another lodger from Cheshire, England, who also fell ill. And then an elderly woman who they invited over got drunk and suffocated. And about this one in particular, Burke later said, quote, "Dr. Knox approved of its being so fresh, but he did not ask any questions." Uh-huh. By February or March, Margaret Hare is noted as actively participating because she lured another old woman to the boarding house. Same scenario as usual plays out, getting them just drunk enough to subdue them. There's more elderly people and at least one kid that I saw sprinkled throughout all the rest. Not only did they target old folks who were lodgers, they also targeted members of society that they thought wouldn't be missed, such as sex workers and the homeless. Keyword, thought. Here's where things start to fall apart. In April, Burke meets Mary Patterson, possibly Mary Mitchell, and her friend Janet Brown. And he buys them drinks. And apparently they hang out all night because he's like, let's go get breakfast. And they leave this tavern they were at with two bottles of whiskey so that they could keep drinking, you know, over waffles like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Mary ends up falling asleep at the table. And Burke and Janet are chatting when Burke's common-law wife, Helen McDougal, comes in and accuses him of cheating on her. And they apparently get into this huge fight. Huge as in, Burke threw a glass at Helen and it shatters against her face and she's got this gash over her eye. So Janet's all, I'm gone, and she dips, leaving Mary there passed out. Cool friend. Real cool friend.
Yeah. Ride or die.
Yeah. Yeah. Real loyal there. My take based on what I read is that this fight was for show. Now, granted, I'm sure that the glass breaking was an accident, but I say that because after Janet leaves, so does Helen, and she's going to get Burke and Margaret. The women stay out of the room while Burke and Hare murder the passed out Mary, and quote, that afternoon, the pair took the body to Knox in a tea chest, while McDougal kept Patterson's skirt and petticoats. They were paid £8 for the corpse, which was still warm when they delivered it. Ferguson, one of Knox's assistants, asked where they had obtained the body, as he thought he recognized her. Burke explained that the girl had drunk herself to death and that they had purchased it from an old woman in Canongate. Knox was delighted with the corpse and stored it in whiskey for 3 months before dissecting it.
What?
I mean, sweet baby Jesus. So they came close to being questioned in a way. I mean, the assistant kind of did question them because, yeah, he recognized Mary. But in the end, Knox simply doesn't care, is the bottom line. Knox doesn't care. And later, Janet comes back around looking for Mary. And they tell her, oh, Mary took off with some traveling salesman. Sure. Mm-hmm. But talking about Mary being familiar to them, there's also other times where when they'd killed sex workers from around town, again, some of Dr. Knox's assistants would be like, hey, isn't that so-and-so who works such and such area? But Knox doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
We carry on into spring and summer, more murders. Things got a little rough for a time in June when Burke noticed that Hare, who he knew didn't have a lot of cash on hand at the time, shows up in some new nice clothes. And sure enough, when Burke and Helen had been out of town, Hare had murdered somebody on his own and sold it to Dr. Knox. So they have this big fight and they break up, you know.
Yeah.
Burke and Helen move out, blah, blah, blah. But they mend fences. And when Hare's over at Burke's place, they just randomly kill the woman who came to do the boarding house laundry. Just cause.
Sloppy.
Shit's really getting crazy. They actually murder a relative of Helen's who was just there visiting. And Helen was like, go ahead.
What? Oh my God. Okay.
And then also, yeah, also around this time in the summer, get this, Margaret actually suggests to Hare that they kill Helen because she thought that they couldn't trust her. Y'all can't trust none of each other. Y'all can't trust anybody. So I feel like to say the wives were totally in on this. They knew plenty. They participated even if they didn't physically kill anyone themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they get even more careless with their victim choices beyond the washerwoman and the relative and the known sex workers. And this next one really raised eyebrows. We're now in October. There was an 18-year-old homeless guy who everybody adored, but apparently not enough to, you know, help him. But whatever, we're not going to go there. But they affectionately, and I say that in heavy air quotes, called him Daft Jamie. His real name was James Wilson, and there was some mental deficit, hence that whole Daft nickname. There, you know, they loved him so much. People kill me. Anyway, but he was also physically handicapped. He had a clubbed foot. And the reason that he was adored was because he was genuinely a sweetheart, and he made his way being a children's entertainer, just this joyful, kind, happy-go-lucky person. Burke and Hare lured him to the house, but Jamie wasn't big on whiskey. He was basically just being sociable, and hell, probably was happy to have a place to stay for the night. But the point is, he doesn't get drunk, and when they go to suffocate him, he puts up a hell of a fight. So they're not even worrying anymore about it looking like a murder. Because, I mean, in my opinion, because Knox has taught them through his looking the other way, Knox has essentially taught them it doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah.
He hasn't explicitly taught them this, but it's implicit. So anyway, this comes up later. They take him to Dr. Knox. And the next day, when the assistants are prepping things around, you know, the dissection rooms or whatever, multiple people were like, Dr. Knox, that's Jamie. Knox, quote, denied it could be anyone that the students knew. When word started circulating that Wilson was missing, Knox dissected the body ahead of the others that were being held in storage. The head and feet were removed before the main dissection. So if you're not already furious with Knox, and if this part didn't seal the deal, I don't know what. Here's how they get caught. We are in November, marking a full year that Burke and Hare have been murdering. There's some lodgers in the boarding house named James and Anne Gray, along with their kids, and they aren't Marks. They're a young, perfectly healthy couple. Plus, there's the kids. There's just no way it could happen. Though, I mean, hell, who's to say these asshats didn't try? Who knows? But they're called in one source an inconvenience, so that's telling to me. And they're in the way because Burke had lured a middle-aged woman by the last name of Doherty over with lies about how his family was from the same area of Ireland that she was from. And hey, let's keep chatting over drinks at my place. Then Hare comes over, and then they and the wives hatch a plan. And they tell the Grays that this woman is a relative who's unexpectedly dropped by, and could they please go stay the night at Hare's place? And they're like, sure, okay. Then around that night at 9 p.m., the Grays came back by because they had forgotten a few things that they need for the kids. And quote, saw Burke, Hare, their wives, and Doherty all drunk, singing and dancing. They go on, and you know what happens from there. So the next day, the Gray family is back, and Burke is acting really weird about letting Anne go into this one particular room. And she was just wanting to check in there to make sure it wasn't where she'd left a pair of stockings that she was hunting for. And the whole thing struck her odd, so she just drops it. And then these idiots, I cannot fathom what they were thinking, but that evening, they end up leaving the Grays in the house alone. So Anne...
okay.
So Anne... who is me and who is probably you, we are all Anne, makes a beeline for that room. And she and her husband find Doherty's body stuffed all up in the straw mattress. And they nope on out of there and go to the police. And they actually, and this is just a nightmare, they actually run into Helen McDougall on the way. And whether they flat out told her what was going on or she just knew, she ends up offering to bribe them with £10 a week if they keep their mouths shut. And I call bullshit. I think the four of them would have killed this entire family because think about it. They're only getting about that much for each body. So there's no way they could have afforded that every single week.
Yeah.
You know, on into however long. There's just no way.
She was just buying time to murder them.
Absolutely. She was buying time until she could get back to the men and be like, hey, we got to take out this whole family. But as I hope the rest of us would be, the Grays are like, screw you, not a chance. So the police take the Grays seriously, and they immediately go to the house. But Burke and Hare have already had a head start because, you know, Helen rushed back to warn them. Now, one might think, just take the loss and get rid of the body. Toss it in a river or something. Nah, these geniuses take it over to Dr. Knox's. Meanwhile, the police have found Doherty's clothes under the bed, and Burke and Helen are... giving conflicting stories about when Doherty supposedly left naked, apparently, I guess.
Yeah.
And they're suspicious, so they take him in. Nothing to pin on Hare and Margaret quite yet. The next morning, the cops go to Knox's, and sure enough, there's Doherty's body in a dissecting room. The Grays positively ID her, and now they do go and arrest Hare and Margaret. All four of them continue to deny everything, and the investigators are smart. They separate them. And as the questioning goes along, the stories get more and more convoluted and conflicting. Outside doctors, two of which specialized in forensics, were called in, and they said, yeah, it's probable that Doherty was murdered, though it couldn't absolutely be proven because it was suffocation. But I will note here that it was mentioned. The Grays said that she had blood in her mouth, and also it was mentioned there was blood on the clothes, and that just smacks of pulmonary edema. So there you go. It's a very reasonable conclusion that they went with suffocation. I mean, they were right. Now, one of these forensic specialists is also there when Dr. Knox is questioned, and about him, it said, quote, he thought Knox was deficient in principle and heart, but did not think he had broken the law. Because Knox's story was that he was under the impression Burke and Hare had been getting bodies by scouting out lodging houses for the poor and purchasing unclaimed bodies, which they then sell to him for a profit, he was kind of in the clear. Which is bullshit, but that
nice
was the story.
Story, yeah.
But another reason he's cleared is because Burke makes a statement that says, Dr. Knox never taught or encouraged me to murder any person. I mean, again, he didn't, but he did. Like we said earlier, it's that implicit versus explicit.
Yeah.
The cops are all but positive there's been a ton of murders, likely based on the amount of bodies that they brought to Knox, and they do more searching. And these people were just beyond dumb. The cops end up with a local baker saying, yeah, he recognized another member of one of their families wearing Jamie's pants. And then Janet Brown was shown clothing found at the house, and she ID'd it as Mary's skirts. I mean, just stupid. Arrogant and stupid. But the cops think Hare is the weakest link because, as noted, Burke was the more well-educated one, and he was kind of the brains, and Hare was the brawn. And the judge offers Hare immunity, and he goes, absolutely. As part of the deal, they give Margaret immunity as well. So Burke and Helen are charged with the murders of Mary, Jamie, and Dougherty. And again, as we have said it before, trials moved at lightning speed back in the day. The jury goes off to deliberate at 8:30 a.m. on Christmas Day and comes back less than an hour later. It ends up, I mean, ho, 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 and we are ready for turkey.
Yeah.
Zoom, zoom. It ends up with them saying that, yeah, if nothing else, Burke is guilty of Dougherty's murder, but they didn't feel there was enough proof on the other counts or proven that Helen was directly involved in the killing, but that, yes, he's definitely guilty of that one, and one is all it takes. Burke is sentenced to death, and the judge says, quote, your body should be publicly dissected and anatomized, and I trust that if it is ever customary to preserve skeletons, yours will be preserved in order that posterity may keep in remembrance your atrocious crimes.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sweet sentencing there.
Uh-huh. So, what happened to everybody? Well, turns out the public didn't give a shit about the immunity and the verdicts. There were stories of mobs chasing Hare and Margaret and Helen at various times, and that the police did shelter them till the mobs cooled down, but then it kicked back up again. And all three of them end up leaving Edinburgh. And there's rumors of where everybody ended up, from England to Ireland to Australia. But who cares? They're scum lords. The public also didn't give a shit about Knox being deemed not responsible. And I'll note that a committee of his peers additionally said that they hadn't seen any evidence that he was complicit in, as in, you know, directly soliciting them to kill. So he wasn't stripped of his license or anything. But boy, howdy, check this. Quote, the common thought in Edinburgh was that he was culpable in the events. He was lampooned in caricature, and in February, a crowd gathered outside his home and burned an effigy of him. Whoa.
Yikes. Okay.
Uh-huh. Wowza. And eventually, his peers did start excluding him from professional shit, and he ends up moving to London and having a small practice, but he wasn't ever a big wig ever again like he was in Edinburgh. And as for Burke, yup, he was indeed hanged. And his body indeed was donated to science to be dissected, just like the judge said. The execution was attended by a super pumped crowd numbering about 25,000.
Wow.
And while I'm here talking about how into this case people were and how angry they were about it, there's this rhyme that went around that ends with Burke's the butcher, Hare's the thief, Knox the boy that buys the beef. Oh, God. Oh, okay. So when Burke was dissected, quote, a number of anatomy students took ghoulish souvenirs of his skin, even using it to bind books and card holders.
Oh, that's a little bit much. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know what, though? It reminds me of, oh, what's her face? Chicken Lady, the Hen of Leeds.
Yeah.
Yeah. They made little change purses and stuff
they
out of her
did.
Skin.
Right.
So anyhow, if you want to meet Burke, you certainly can, because his skeleton's on display at Surgeon's Hall, along with his death mask. But what does this have to do with Arthur's seat dolls? The last theory is that these 17 dolls were made by someone to honor Burke and Hare's victims, at least the 16 known ones. Maybe the maker knew of one more. Some folks have suggested maybe Burke or Hare or both of them were making the dolls out of some sort of guilt, or maybe even like as serial killer souvenirs. But the timeline wouldn't match up given when they were caught, because remember, this was like a day or two after they killed that last woman. They got snatched up. So they wouldn't have had time to make a doll to represent her and take it up to Arthur's seat. It's simply not a plausible theory.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing people have pointed out is that most of Burke and Hare's victims were women, and that all the dolls were dressed as men. It's easier to sew a little skirt. What's with all the pants? But it makes sense to me, because as said, these were likely repurposed soldier dolls. And you got to think, back then, the mentality was probably, these are boy dolls. Boys wear pants. That is that.
Okay.
Because of this theory and the popularity of it, sometimes you'll see these called the Burke and Hare murder dolls. Can't prove it, but it's a cool one. So I'll finish off with a quote from historian and curator David Forsyth, who says, "It's very interesting that the coffins continue to be talked about and remain among our most popular exhibits, even after all the debate about their origins. However, I think that the connection to the victims of Burke and Hare remains the most likely explanation." Or, you know, some morbid, fucked up kid. That I'm thinking about like the kid knew that he was a little left of center, so he was hiding all this shit from his parents. I'm thinking of that quote from Thelma and Louise where Susan Sarandon's like got the gun on the guy. She's like, "You got a real fucked up idea, fun." So this could just be, again, calling back to Robert the Doll. Maybe this is just a weird little kid. I don't know.
Interesting, though. There was a lot that I had never heard of in your story. Those guys were fucked up, though. Holy crap.
When I think of serial killers, to me, these are the ones that fall into the category of numeric serial killers, like strictly by definition serial killers. Because when I think of serial killers, like, you know, there's some sort of drive and, dare I say, passion there. There's something's going on. These guys, though, were all about the money. They were trying to be as efficient as possible. Granted, they screwed up as time went on and got lazy. So the whole them making dolls as sort of like souvenirs and or out of repentance, they just wanted money, man. This wasn't like a passion project.
No, I agree. I get what you're saying, that for the most part, serial killers, they have some underlying, like you said, a passion for what it is that they're doing, why they're killing, for what's driving them. And yeah, these guys were definitely just scummy, horrible people.
Exactly. Exactly. This was a means to an end type of thing. This wasn't like, oh, I hadn't had a kill in a couple days.
Mm-mm.
I mean, there were sickos, but yeah. So there's your duo of creepy doll stories.
There it is indeed.
That's it.
So there you go. I want to know if anyone has seen Robert. I want to know if he's messing with your life. I want to know if anyone has coffin dolls.
Yeah, did you bury dolls?
Many, many minutes later.
I don't know how much of this will have gotten edited if I've edited anything at all.
And now, a message from Nash.
Hey kids, it's future Nash. Well, it's past Nash now, but less past Nash than episode Nash. Past Nash sounds like past Nash, like you physically passed something medically, as in a parasite. Like, oh good, Karen finally passed that Nash. What am I talking about? But yes, I'm interrupting the episode when there's literally only moments left in it to tell you that indeed stuff did get edited out. Tiff and I digressed at a few points throughout the stories into what turned out to be fairly amusing stuff. Things about dolls we had back in the day, some childhood shenanigans, there was a cornhole story. That's a lawn game, get your minds out of the gutter. Unfortunately, it all had to be cut for time's sake, but we didn't want to deprive you of our stellar wit, #humble. So it's going to be bonus content over on the YouTube channel, which has a convoluted URL. Trying to tell it to you would be a mess, but you can search for the channel under our name over there, and it'll be in the playlist called Bonus Clips. Or, even easier, you could just subscribe to the channel, I'm just saying. But the direct link to the vid will also be on the episode post over at the blog, so you can just click and go. And even though you're going to hear it in the outro, I'll remind you here anyway, it's youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. And if you're future you, like way future you, it won't be the top post or one of the top posts any longer, but you can click on the episodes link and scroll till you see it, or you can click on the master post of episodes link and find it easily. That's it. I'm done. Back to past me and past Tiff. We are not parasites. Here lies the end of the show. Hope you guys enjoyed. And this is where the catchphrase goes.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.